Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Anicca vata-saṅkhāra upādavāya dhammino upajjitavā niruccanti tesaṁ upassamo sukho ti. All the monks would have recognized that little Pali phrase at the beginning of this talk. It's usually what we chant at funerals, but it's not going to be a funeral talk. This particular phrase means impermanent to all formations. From arising, that they are the nature to fade away. Having arisen, they will go to cessation. And calming those formations is happiness. And I wanted to especially focus on that last phrase, that calming the sankharas is happiness. And in particular, that calming that particular mental formation, which we call thinking or thought. The first few talks I give on a rains retreat, and this is the first talk of this rains retreat, this Wasa 2002. The first few talks are always how-to type talks, giving some more information, guidance, tips on how to develop meditation. And in particular, that I stress that meditation practice in a retreat situation, because all of the understanding you gain from books or from discussions or even from listening to talks isn't worth a 16th part, to use the simile from the suttas, isn't worth a 16th part of actually experience. And it is through the practice of meditation that one begins to experience the Dhamma which the Lord Buddha taught. When we talk about suffering, we need to get some perspective in order to understand what suffering is. When we're immersed in suffering, when it's all around us, when we live in it, when we eat it, when we go to sleep in it, then we don't know it's suffering. We're just too close to it. And one of the purposes of meditation, especially the jhana meditations, is leaving that world of suffering just for a short time, but enough to give you perspective of what the Buddha actually meant by this first noble truth of dukkha. And also, because the way into such deep meditations is always giving up craving, and one realizes that the craving, the desires, the attachments are what stops you getting into these jhanas and keeps you in this realm of suffering, you begin to penetrate the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. And you find the third noble truth, that when you can let go of those cravings, you just leave things alone, stop messing around with your mind, stop being a control freak, it gets very peaceful and very blissful and a great deal of freedom. You're penetrating the third noble truth. And you're finding out just that your samadhi practice depends upon a right view, having some basic understanding of the Dhamma. It depends upon right thought, or right intention, the second noble truth. It depends upon your sila, your practice of sense, of restraint of the body, speech and mind. And it depends upon your effort, mindfulness, in order to give rise to the eighth factor of samadhi. And so we're penetrating the fourth factor as well. So the meditation which we're doing here is not just for the purpose of calming the mind and blissing out, but by so doing, you're penetrating into basic Buddhist teachings, not thinking about them, but experiencing them. And in order to get into those deep states of meditation, you have to stop those thoughts. And for the person who's beginning meditation, or even those who have been meditating a while, sometimes the biggest obstacle is the wandering thoughts. The thoughts which seem to obsess the mind, always coming into the mind, blocking you off from the deep states of meditation, or even the medium states of meditation. Not only do they block off meditation, but when thoughts are encouraged inside of you, and when they possess your mind, then they can start to deviate into all sorts of lust or hatred or ill will or grief or anxiety or fear. And those are all built up by devious thoughts, which are missing the track of truth and going off into these side alleys of suffering. And unless we understand thoughts and learn how to calm them down and even to let go of them completely, we're always going to be prey to the moods which roll through our mind from time to time. All of those moods which affect you, whether it's moods of despair or elation, whether it's moods of anger or ill will or worry or anything which obsesses you, even lust or a sensory desire, you find it's all built up like a huge edifice, building, all built up of the bricks of many, many thoughts. So if we can actually look at these bricks which make up these emotions and moods which give us so much trouble, we can look at the bricks and don't even lay the first brick, or at least to take out the bricks of this edifice, the whole thing falls down. So we're looking at thoughts and what they are and how we could manage to let go of those thoughts. When you start meditating, especially the beginning of a retreat, sometimes thoughts can run wild. And very often, if thoughts are running wild, what an unskilled person tries to do is to try and just to force those thoughts out of the mind, just using your willpower. Now, if any of you remember sort of the teachings of the Buddha in the Vitakka Santara Sutta, I think, that's the last resort to use, you know, brute force to force these thoughts out of your mind. There's many other things you should try first of all, and I would recommend that. Because if you just try force, you'll find you're very often just making more thoughts. You're adding thoughts onto thoughts, and of course that's no way to stop the problem. Instead of using brute force, we have to use like wisdom power, not willpower, for this beginning stage of the meditation. And the wisdom power should tell you, especially if you've heard me teach before or read some of the books which I've written about meditation, to know that the thoughts mostly play around in the past or the future or in fantasy land. They never actually play around in the present moment. There's nothing much to think about in the present moment. And one of the first things to notice about the thinking is that it always goes into the past, the future, or dream world, imaginary world. Very rarely, if at all, can it say much about what is happening right in this moment. Which is why present moment awareness, when developed, can very quickly cut through a lot of the thinking. But of course, first of all, you have to, like any psychologist will tell you, you have to want, you know, to stop that playing around in the past and the future. And this is one of the great problems with human beings when they begin the practice of training their mind. And because we're so used to playing around in the past and the future, or to dreaming and fantasizing, because we are conditioned to do such, it takes a while for us to unlearn the old habits and to learn new ones. So you have to be very patient with your practice of meditation in a monastery like this. Very patient, continually inclining towards present moment awareness, and also inclining towards delighting in that present moment awareness. In the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the first thing we say to do is actually substitution. In other words, replace one way of thinking with another way. And what that really means, the only way you can substitute is to substitute something better for what you have already. It's like having a deal, doing a swap. You know, if you like sort of the deal, then you go for it. And substitution will never work unless what you're substituting in the place of what you have already is something more delightful, more better, more enjoyable. And so if you're going to give up the thinking of the past and the future, or fantasy world, it has to be something better, something more enjoyable. Which is why that I've taught here for many years, sort of developing what is called the Subha Nimitta, or you might like to call it Subha Sanya, the perception of the beautiful, with every stage of the meditation you're doing, even in present moment awareness, to actually look at the present moment, to train yourself to look at the present moment as a wonderful place to hang out in. Very often, if we don't actually look at the present moment or any other stage in the meditation, something beautiful, wonderful, delightful and valuable to us, then of course we will not be able to stay there. With all the willpower in the world, you'll find that the mind will slip back into its old habits of just hanging out in the past, or hanging out into the future, or hanging out in fantasies and dreams. Why? Why does a monk or a novice, an anagarika, a layman, a laywoman staying here think sexual fantasies? Because the mind thinks they are fun. And if you have nothing better than that, you'll find that all the willpower in the world will not be able to stop you. You have to use the wisdom power, actually, to see, is that really fun? Or is like staying in the present moment more fun? So we train ourselves to investigate, you know, the the fun faculty, the joy faculty, the beauty faculty, which is associated with just being right here, right now, in the present moment. So whenever we do practice present moment awareness, we should always just check it out, just what it feels like, how it feels, what it's like for us, its benefits for us. And if we do that again and again and again, always teaching ourselves, always encouraging ourselves, saying, mind, look, this is nice, this is pleasant, this is wonderful, this is how I want to live, I want to be present, I wasted too much time already in the past and futures of fantasies, this is nice, this is beautiful. If you train yourself like that, then your mind will incline to be present. And you won't need to exercise willpower, because it becomes a natural abiding. This is how we train ourselves, not through willpower, but through wisdom power, and through appreciating that the nature of the mind, being impersonal, will always incline to where it finds pleasure. So by developing the Subha Nimitta, the perception of the beautiful with the present moment, you'll find that the mind will stay in the present moment longer and longer, it will move towards the present moment longer and longer, and all of the difficulties of what you did in the past, yesterday, last week, early on in your life, or what's going to happen afterwards, will tend just to disappear. You can't think about them, because you're inclining to something else which you know is beautiful. This is the way of substitution. It has to be something better than what you've had before. Otherwise, it will not work. And as you substitute these things, that part of that substitution is also the second part of the Vitakka Santara Sutta, is seeing the danger in not in staying with the past or the future or with the fantasy world. Seeing the danger in these things. And this is, I've used this simile before, and it's actually straight from the sutta. It's like to look at things like thoughts, with as asupa. Asupa is the opposite of beauty, it's the ugliness, it is the disgusting nature of things. And very often they use like asupa gamatan, which is the meditation on the impurities, on the ugliness, on the disgusting nature of things. And most of the meditation teachers in Thailand only talk about asupa gamatan, the perception of the ugliness or the disgusting nature of things with the body. But I have in the past, and I do so even now, I use asupa gamatana, the meditation on the disgusting, on the thoughts, looking at thinking as being sort of disgusting, as being impure, as being ugly, as being something which is stopping me enjoying myself. And the simile which the Buddha actually gives in the Vitakka Santara Sutta, Santana Sutta, is that of a young man or a young woman fond of ornaments who has a carcass of a dead dog or a dead snake or a dead human being around their neck. And so you can imagine just having a corpse, you know, dead for many days, hung around your neck. You'd be disgusted with that. That's what the Supagamatthana does. It gets you to see that this is something which is not very beautiful, not very nice, not very pleasant, and so that you take off that carcass of a dead dog and throw it away. And it's something which is defiling your body in that simile. In the same way that after a while you look at these thoughts, you know, which are like a garland which you put around your jitta, your beautiful radiant mind, and which defile that mind, just like a carcass of a dog slung around your neck would defile you. When you actually see the danger in these thoughts, so their impurity, I'm talking about any thoughts here, see their disgusting nature, because they're defiling something very pure and very beautiful. If ever you do get into deep meditations where there are no thoughts, you'll understand what I mean. That these thoughts, they haven't any value, but we give them value. And this is a way of taking away their value, so that we don't play with them anymore, but we sort of take them away, we discard them. So this is the second way of overcoming the thoughts which go into the past and the future, or into fantasy world, developing disgust with these things. And it's important to be able to do this, because otherwise we will keep on thinking, we'll be prey to the wandering mind. Many, many years ago, you know, when my mind used to wander around a lot, I'd always investigate. I wasn't just the monk who just pressed my mind down with willpower to get samatha or to get jhana states. I used wisdom power a lot. And whenever thinking came, I often wondered, why do those thoughts actually come into my mind? Very often that thoughts come in uninvited. And you wonder where that thought came from and why it stayed. And after a lot of reflection, investigation, time and time again, trying things out, it was always because I valued thinking. I thought it was important. And especially I thought it was going to reach some conclusion which was going to be valuable for me. I was going to work out the solution to something. That's why I used to plan, because I thought if I planned a lot, then I'd be safe and secure. If I planned out how I was going to give my talk, how I was going to conduct an interview, if I prepared and planned what I was going to do tomorrow, then I'd be safe and secure, get everything done. And of course, now you all know from your own experience that the nature of the future is uncertain, that things always change, that you cannot predict even a few moments from now. So why go to all this planning when, as usual, it all goes wrong? It never works out according to your plan. And so understanding that, you can realize it's a waste of time to do too much planning. You're actually just seeing just the value less in the thoughts of the future. When you look to the past and all your memories of who said what and why and what you did. There are arguments in this monastery, and I get involved in these arguments sometimes. I don't take them to real big arguments. So who did what, when and how? Did I really say that? In my job as an abbot, sometimes people tell me, well, are you allowed to take chocolate back, or are you allowed to take this back? I can't remember what I said. I know I can't remember what I said, because the past is impermanent. And my memory my memory is always fallible. You never know what you said, and you don't remember what I said either. Who knows what I said? So the past is that uncertain that when we actually bring up the past and start thinking about it and worrying about it, a lot of the time you're worrying about something which never happened. You're adding so much onto what happened. That's what thought does. It's untrue. It's unfaithful to the facts. You add so much onto what really happened, and also you omit so much as to what really happened. So when you really reflect upon that and keep that in your mind again and again and again, all thoughts about the past lose their value. All thoughts of the future lose their value. All thoughts of fantasies lose their value, because you never really get happiness that way. It's just like putting off doing the task. And when you take the value out of thinking, it's just like, you know, looking at the thoughts like dead dogs. If you imagine the next thought which comes into your mind like a dead dog, smelly, stinking, full of maggots, and the next thought, the next thought, and the next thought, then the thoughts, how will they be able to survive in your mind? Your mind will turn away from them and go into the silence. So by looking at all the thoughts which go into your mind as valueless, it's like seeing the danger in them. So you've always got like the substitute in putting something more beautiful in there, in other words, the present moment awareness, and also seeing the danger, looking upon these things as dead dogs. And then they'll actually start to stop. You won't value them anymore. Instead, you'll value the silence. This is substitution again. You're substituting something which you're learning is much more beautiful, much more wonderful. Because that substitution is such an important thing, that we can actually substitute just the thinking with some other object, just like the breath, or like loving kindness, or like counting the breath, or like reflecting on the Buddha. Because when we put something else in there which we enjoy even more, then of course the thoughts can't stay. The mind will always go to what it enjoys more, which is why whatever meditation one is doing, it's good to make that meditation object beautiful. If you're breathing in and breathing out, make sure you breathe a beautiful breath. Again, it's doing the supasanya, the perception of the beautiful with your meditation object. So don't just breathe out any old thoughts or any. Don't just breathe in or breathe out any type of breath. Breathe in a beautiful one. Make it sort of even sensuous. In other words, you know, lovely to feel. And that way that it will be easier to watch. And take it easy. Don't sort of put yourself in a posture which is just too painful. And don't sit too long. If there's too much pain in there, then of course the mind will go to that pain and won't be able to stay with the breath. Make sure the whole meditation is wonderful and lovely. Sometimes what has happened with some meditators, they decided to force their mind, you know, through the meditation, just watch the breath no matter what, and because it's painful and they don't get anywhere, time and time and time again, they develop a psychological block to meditation. The mind associates meditation with pain and difficulty. And I remember one monk who had that association. The way he was taught meditation was to really push, 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 and to strive, strive, strive. And he got so tense that every time he watched the breath, even at the very beginning, his whole body and mind would tense up. It was almost like, you know, a trauma for him to watch the breath, because out of so many years of breath meditation, it was always so unpleasant. It became impossible to block, impossible to break that association between the breath and pain. And eventually he disrobed. And all because he never was taught properly in the first place to make the breath meditation beautiful, wonderful. Now take it easy, don't be so hard upon yourself. And so when we develop this perception of beauty along with the breath, then it's like a substitution which will work. It's the same when sometimes they've read my book I say about counting with the breath. As long as the counting is fun, it will work. But if the counting becomes unpleasant and you force yourself to count with the breath, you know, breathing in one, breathing out one and all of that, if you force yourself and it's not pleasant anymore, then again you'll start to wander. Or if you try to stay with that, you get yourself so tight and tense that you get headaches and you won't get into the beautiful deep states of meditation. Those beautiful deep states of meditation are born of happiness, ease, comfort, contentment, not out of stress. The second noble truth says that, you know, that sort of craving, that sort of stress leads to suffering. Letting go leads to nirvana. So we should always remember when we meditate to meditate according to the third noble truth of letting go, not meditating according to the second noble truth, which is craving, wanting, controlling. So as we understand this, whatever meditation object we do, because we're doing the substitution, we have to make that meditation object or find some skillful means to make that beautiful. So loving kindness is by its very nature a very beautiful meditation object to cultivate. And it's full of joy, which is why that many people in our Buddhist society in Perth do loving kindness meditation and get great results. It's a very joyful meditation. You're in there, you are using some thoughts, but all those thoughts are directed on one thing, developing the feeling, the emotion, the meditation object, which we call metta, loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. And when we keep on pointing the mind in that direction again and again and again and again and again, having directed thoughts, it becomes so much fun doing this that other thoughts, they just cannot come in. Now, thoughts about the past or the future, even the worst things which have happened to you in the past, or any fears of the future, or any sexual fantasies or dreams or imaginations, they can't come in because you're having too good a time. In the same way that you cannot think about the future or the past, you know, as lay people, when you were listening to a good piece of music, you couldn't even sexually fantasize when you're watching a great movie, because you were absorbed in the moment, you're having such a good time. So this is actually how we manage to stay with our meditation object. We can only substitute when that meditation object, or whatever we're substituting, is much better than what we had before. And we can learn how to do that by seeing the danger in the thoughts and by allowing those meditation objects to be happy by developing the perception of the beauty. And the breath is very beautiful. Loving kindness is very beautiful. If you're someone who has a lot of faith, just thinking or meditating, reflecting on the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha is very beautiful. If you've been to the holy places in India, you can reflect upon those. It brings up a lot of happiness. And you see in the suttas again and again that when the mind gets tired or starts to think and starts to wander, you have to bring up a subhanimitta, sort of something which the mind can delight in, which finds happiness in. And that stops the thinking. So you don't stop the thinking by willpower. Say, I'm going to stop thinking. Right, this is it. I'm going to sit here, I'm not going to think for the next hour. You can't do that. I was telling someone early in some of the interviews that in my, I think, fifth rains retreat or sixth rains retreat, staying by myself in a very remote monastery, I was the only monk in this monastery, that there was a time when my mind started to get lost in thoughts, especially fantasies. And I tried everything I could possibly do to try and stop this, and what actually finally worked was I decided, okay, I'll do a deal with my mind, that I'll be watching the breath for most of the day, but I'll give a time between 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. and I'll just sit in my hut and I'll allow myself to fantasize about anything. Anything goes between 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. The rest of the time I'll watch the breath. And I made the aditana. I think I actually made the aditana in front of the Buddha statue in the monastery. And so for all of the day I was fighting, you know, to try and be with the breath. Even I made that deal, you know, the mind would sort of fight against it. And so fantasies would try and creep in, but I'd fight back and try and stay with the breath. And I keep on saying, it doesn't matter, mind, that you get your hour of fantasy, that we can do whatever you want between 3 and 4. I fought all the day. And it was hard to watch the breath. When it came to 3 o'clock, I sort of leant against the wall of my hut, put my feet out and said, okay, now you can fantasize. And as soon as I said that, all the mind wanted to do was watch the breath. That's what it did for the next hour. It watched the breath really easy. It didn't want to fantasize. And it's amazing just what you were doing there, and just the psychology of the mind, which is why if any of you have any problems with these sorts of things, if you have problems with the past or problems with the future or problems with anxiety or anger against somebody in this monastery, Then use the time, 3 to 4 in the afternoon, or whatever other time, but set a time. This is a time I'm going to get angry at that guy in the kitchen. But the rest of the time, you'd watch the breath and develop loving kindness. And sit in your hut or your room, get your clock out. Okay, this is angry time. And see what happens. See if you can really get angry. It's just using psychology to actually to bust through the illusion of the mind, and especially the illusion of thoughts. You find you won't be able to do it. And so what this is actually doing is just using skillful means to stop sort of the mind thinking. As you develop these skillful means, if I can remember the Vitaka Santana Sutta, I think the next one is actually slowing it down slowly, stage by stage, from many thoughts to one thought, from one thought to no thoughts. Slowing down this thinking. That's why that sometimes you teach, like doing things like counting or loving kindness when you begin, may the all beings be happy and well. You're still thinking, but you're directed thinking rather than scattered thinking. So that's a way of making a transition from thoughts going all over the place at 100 miles an hour to going down the gears, slowing down stage by stage to 80 miles an hour to 60 to 40 to 20 to 10. Until you slow down altogether and stop. And there's many different ways of doing that. Sometimes when you're watching the breath, sometimes you can have a little commentary going along with the breath and make it interesting. Like I sometimes do when I'm breathing in all the beautiful oxygen from the trees and the flowers. It's their gift to me. When I breathe out, I'm breathing out all the carbon compounds, the carbon dioxide, which again is the gift for me to the flowers and the trees. So by thinking that way, you can inspire yourself that that you are an environmentally sensitive meditation monk on the breath. And some people can get off on that. And what it does, it makes it interesting. So instead of allowing the mind to wander off, the mind actually sticks with the breath. And having a little commentary like that can sometimes help. Having the commentary with the meditation on loving kindness, or having the commentary on the meditation on the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And you start thinking of all of the great monks you've known. You name them, you describe them, remember the monasteries they were in. It's still thinking, but it's directed thoughts. And so by doing this, you're practicing that way of slowing down thinking by abandoning thoughts which are all over the place to thoughts which are directed, and then from directed thoughts to single thoughts to no thoughts at all. And as one develops these ways, the other ways is ignoring the thoughts altogether, which is a very hard thing to do. And the fifth way is actually completely suppressing those thoughts using willpower, but that is really a last resort. I would always recommend the first two ways, the substitution and seeing the danger in the thoughts, is by far the most effective way of overcoming the thinking mind. After a while, that you can develop that silence inside the mind, which actually knows what's happening, but it isn't giving it a name. And when you don't give it a name, you're not supplying the seed for further thoughts to develop. Now, whatever you're experiencing it, and if you actually give it a name and describe it to yourself, first of all, that name, that designation is only an approximation, because just the thought in the terms of a name, a word inside the mind, a designation, it's not the experience, it's not the object, it's not the person. You just have enough wisdom now to know that. So the names are very deluding. That you call me Ajahn Brahm, that's not what I am. You call me Abbot, that's not what I am. You can call me 28 years as a monk, that's not what I am. Whatever name you actually give, it's not the thing itself. So if you actually stop the very first part of thinking, the first name which comes up, and just the experience without giving it a name, then again you can stop the thoughts at their very initial place where they start to grow. You just understand or experience things without naming them. It's what I call just gathering data. You can give them the names later on. You can work out what they mean later on. But now you're just gathering the data of your meditation experience. Now, when the breath goes in and breath goes out, whatever happens, just don't give it a name. You can feel it. You can know it. You know, beyond naming. And when you don't name it, well, thoughts just can't start. And as you do this, if you can still keep on that subanimitta, developing the sense of beauty and joy in the present moment, now with the breath or with loving kindness or reflections on the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, then you'll find that the mind will delight in that silence. It will enjoy it so much that when the mind finishes meditating, it won't go off thinking about so many things. When you're in the kitchen, it won't go thinking about things. You know, when you are eating, it won't go thinking about things, because it enjoys the silence so much. Just when you're eating your food, just try and keep silent. Don't go thinking. Your mind should be on what you're eating. And one way of doing that is to do the one spoon at a time practice, which means that in your bowl or on your plate or whatever else you're eating from, you take a spoon or a fork or a morsel of food and you put that into your mouth and you chew it mindfully, you swallow it, and only then do you think what you're going to eat next. Very often that, you know, by the time you've got the food in your mouth, you've always got another spoon waiting in your bowl, waiting to be eaten. And you're already thinking what's going to go on your spoon next, usually two or three spoons ahead of yourself. You can see how you're thinking into the future. So one spoon at a time practice means that whatever you are choosing now, you choose it now, you bring it up to your mouth, you put it in mindfully, you chew it, you swallow it, and only then do you work out what you're going to eat next. You don't plan two or three morsels into the future. Little things like that is like how to be silent. So you can develop that silence, you know, not indulging in thoughts, throughout the day. And you'll find as you develop that silence while you're eating, or you develop that silence while you're washing the dishes, or you develop that silence while you're cleaning the hall, and you're not sort of thinking about, you know, who hasn't cleaned it before or whatever, but you're developing silence there. You're making the mind peaceful. And you're just knowing, just, you know, I'm cleaning the hall, or I'm cleaning the dishes, or I'm washing the Ajahn's bowl or whatever. And not thinking too much. And delighting in the silence of the mind. As you delight in the silence of the mind throughout the day, it means that when you start meditating, the mind will already be prepared in such silence. And these rotten thoughts, which keep on invading you and stopping the mind enjoying the bliss of deep meditations, those rotten thoughts, they don't even come up in the beginning, let alone in the middle or the end. And so you're actually calming the thinking mind down through what you're doing during the rest of the day. One of the reasons why we have precepts, why we have, well, call what, the monastic rule, is because you don't have to think about things. This is the way it's done. These are the rules, so you don't have to worry about, you know, what time we're going to eat or how we're going to do this. It's already set out for us. So it stops the real opportunity to think. Most people in this monastery don't have to think about anything at all. There's no jobs to do, there's no problems to solve. You know when you're going to eat, and you just go there and eat. You don't have to choose your food and think about it. You don't have a menu. So you have to think, what am I going to eat today? You can't go and tell the anagogues or the cook what you want to eat. You can't go and ring out for a pizza and sort of and have all the choice. What particular pizza do you want today, sir? You don't have to think about anything here. So that is the opportunity. That's the reason why we have precepts and a way of doing things here, because it stops the mind having to think. But of course there will always be a use for thinking. And that use for thinking in one's meditation will be at the end of the meditation. This is the time to do a little bit of thought when you assess, you know, your progress in each meditation. At the end of the meditation, you first of all, how do I feel? What have I been doing? How did I get here? And if you assess each meditation at the end, and also ask yourself what you've been doing throughout the last half an hour, 2 hours, or whatever, then this is where thinking has a point. You're gathering in all the information, gathering all the data together, and analyzing, assessing it. And that's how you learn about meditation, through experience. Sometimes it's such a shame, such a waste, when someone sort of meditates and they have a really good meditation, really peaceful, very deep, and then afterwards, wow, that was good, and they get up and go and do something else, without really reflecting on why it was a good meditation. What did you do, or what did you not do? What was different this time than the last time? And also, that good meditation, how did it feel? They really get into and indulge in that feeling, the payoff of a good meditation, because that's going to encourage the mind to go back there again. The more the mind can recognize just how beautiful that is, in deep meditation, at the very end, the more it will incline all by itself without you telling it. And it's such a valuable thing to do at the end of every good meditation, just to stay there and indulge. If you keep saying at the end of every meditation, no attachment, you know, this is just ordinary, it's the same, samsara and nibbana are all the same. If you talk like that to your mind, then the mind's not going to go back there anymore. You're not going to encourage the mind. So indulge at the very end of a good meditation, so you're encouraging the mind to go back again. Then if you have a bad meditation, instead of at the end of the bad meditation, oh, I'm hopeless, this is terrible, and just get up and do something else. Now just sit there. What does it feel like to have a bad meditation? And why? What have you been doing? So you reflect back on all you've been doing after bad meditation. So you can learn from it, learn from your mistakes, so you don't have to do them again. So this is a time when there is a time for thinking, at the end of every meditation. Not in the middle, nor the beginning. This is where we're going to quieten ourselves down. As many of you know, when the Buddha started talking about the gross, the medium and refined obstacles to meditation, you know, including such thoughts about thoughts about lust, thoughts about ill will, thoughts about cruelty. I think those are the medium ones. That the beginning part of the meditation was supposed to be abandoning such thoughts. We abandon, 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 abandon. But there comes a time in the meditation when the gross, the medium and refined obstacles have been abandoned, and the last one, which you should always be very, very wary of, the lingering obstacle, as was translated once, is Dhamma Vitakka, which is thoughts about Dhamma. And that is an obstacle to deep meditation. It's an obstacle to the realization of the path and the fruits. What was meant in this sutta is that, you know, when you get rid of the grosser thoughts, the wandering thoughts, in the ways described, and you get into peacefulness, into present moment awareness and silence, and you get onto the breath and everything is beautiful, you haven't got many thoughts going on, and maybe even the breath starts to disappear. Too often that people then start thinking of the Dhamma. And you can start thinking about dependent origination and Four Noble Truths and the Five Khandhas, and you can go into, you can actually give yourself a sermon better than I can on a Wednesday evening at that stage. And it's delightful to listen to yourself expounding the Dhamma, and it all looks so clear, and you're working it all out, and it's just so obvious. But you're missing the point. Now that's just the words, that's just the thoughts. Now it's just the last thing, the last obstacle which Mara throws up as a last bribe to stop you going deeper into actually to realizing the Dhamma rather than thinking about it. So even that vitakka, Dhamma vitakka, is an obstacle, you know, to the meditation success. You'll find that the vitakka is abandoned altogether. And if you're going to talk about meditation, describe it from different aspects, different facets of the meditation, one way of describing the meditation called jhanas is the gradual abandoning of vitakka, the gradual subsiding of thought, until it completely disappears. It's a fantastic description of what meditation is all about. And we start with the grosser thoughts, the middle thoughts, the refined thoughts, even Dhamma thoughts, we abandon. So instead of actually naming and cogitating, we're experiencing. And as we experience more and more and more, we start to realize that where those thoughts come from, and what actually makes a thought in the mind. And if you look very carefully, again at the end of a meditation, not the middle, you're actually gathering the data in the beginning, the middle of the meditation. It's the end, you work it all out, give it names to give yourself a map. You always find that all of those thoughts come from discontent. You're not really happy. Therefore, a thought comes up into the mind. The mind moves. Thinking is a movement of the mind. And if it moves enough, then it creates one thought. If it moves further, it creates two, three, and it goes off into papancha. Just a little tremble coming into a whole earthquake of the mind, which is what papancha is, like the earthquakes. There are these seismic movements of the mind. And you all realize what destruction those thoughts can create there in your lives. All starts from just a minor tremor, all caused from discontent, a lack of balance. And if you see that very clearly, you understand just what samatha is, what meditation is developing that balance, that quietness, that contentment so much that not just the body can't move, but the mind can't move. The mind gets still and gets peaceful. It's a calming down of everything. You know the distraction of the body always moving, and just the pain of the body always moving, scratching this and moving that. I've often said the only time when the body is happy, the only time the body is happy is not when you're eating, it's not during sex, it's not listening to music or seeing a movie. The only time the body is really happy is when it's absolutely still in meditation. That's when you can leave the body aside and it's comfortable, it's settled. It's even more comfortable than in sleep. In sleep you're still moving backwards and forwards, rolling around. But in meditation you're just sitting there and the body is just nice, so nice you don't have to move it, scratch it. It's completely disappeared. That's the highest body happiness, is where it's gone. That's where you can understand why the highest mental happiness is when the mind is gone. And the highest thought happiness is when thought is gone. So as we calm that mind down, we're actually calming the source of thoughts down. We're getting more and more contentment, more and more inner happiness, more and more stillness. And when the mind gets really happy, what do you need to think for? Why do you not want to disturb this? You're just so happy where you are, just you can't move. And when one gets into the nimittas, these beautiful nimittas, be careful that they're born of stillness. You're having a reflection of the mind, your mind. And if you start thinking about it, you're just stirring everything else, everything up. It's like a person is looking into a bowl of water at the image of their face. And then they start shaking that water up and down. Now what's the image going to do? The image is going to move and it's going to distort. You won't be able to see it clearly enough. Its brilliance, its beauty is going to fade away because of the waves you create. Which is why that when you get into deep states of meditation, you've got nimittas coming up, don't start thinking and naming. You don't need to name the nimitta. Whether it's a white nimitta, a yellow nimitta, a green nimitta or polka dot nimitta or whatever, just leave that alone. No naming, no thinking, no planning. When you say, what should I do now? That's thinking of the future. You're going into the future. You're not in the present moment anywhere. You've lost present moment awareness. What should I do next? It doesn't matter what next is going to be. It's what's happening now is the only thing to worry about or be concerned about. So when you develop that present moment awareness, just what do I do next just doesn't come up. What happened just now doesn't come up. All that is in the mind is what's happening now. So you're not moving. And all descriptions, you're just going before descriptions arise. That state before naming happens. You're knowing. Knowing in the present moment, just the nimitta. When you're knowing the nimitta in the present moment awareness and silence, that which you've built up from the very beginning, it means it's so easy to be with the nimitta. You're being with it as it happens, you're not disturbing anything. You're holding a bowl of water in your hands as you look at your face, in the reflection in the water. Because you're so still, you see the reflection. And you're so happy that everything just gets so still and more still. The mind doesn't move. The first jhana is always where there's a slight bit of movement left, but it always has to be subverbal. Anyone who says that thinking is there in the jhanas has never experienced jhanas at all, I say. And it's obvious why, because you all know what thinking is like, that naming. That's not refined at all. That's not sort of something superlative. That's not uttari manusa dhamma. Uttari manusa dhamma means like superior human states. The thinking is ordinary. You're never going to get to enlightenment, which is, you know, sublime and hard to see, with an ordinary state of mind. You have to get into the stillness. The stillness means no thinking disturbing it. The mind is not moving. All thought is a movement of the mind coming from discontent. So you build up more and more content. And if you're discontent with the food you get here, you don't think about it. But if you don't like the food, you start thinking about apple pies and fish and chips and pizzas and whatever else it is you like. But if you're really content, you don't think at all. If you're content with your heart, you don't think about something else. If you're content with what you've got there, you don't think about putting in shelves. If you're content just where you are, you're not thinking about going somewhere else. All thinking comes from discontent. Please know that. And so if you really want to stop the thoughts, develop contentment. It's like gratitude for what you have, rather than seeing that what you haven't got. Just appreciating just a moment, rather than fault finding. And if you fault find, then you're going to think. If you appreciate what's been done, where you've come to, what's here, then what's there to think about? I often said that thinking comes from discontent, and discontent comes from the sense of self, ego, trying to control things. When the ego disappears, then when there's less and less control, you give up and let go, then more contentment comes. You don't get involved anymore. You just let go. So that little bit of anatta helps develop that contentment. You're not controlling, because there's no controller. Thus one develops those deep states of meditation. Now you're developing the contentment, you're also developing the sense of non-self. Because when the thoughts finish altogether, and you get into the first jhana, there's still that movement of the mind onto the nimitta, the subverbal. And when you actually have the confidence, that's the factor in the second jhana called sampasadanam, ajatang sampasadanam. So the internal confidence or happiness of the mind, whichever way you wish to call it, you're just delighting in the inside, in the nimitta. You're delighting, have confidence in it, which means you don't move at all. It's that almost fulfillment of contentment. Fulfillment of the joyful contentment. You're so happy, you're so content, you don't move at all. That's where vitakkawa thought ends, in the second jhana. And it's not that hard to experience those states, where in the second jhana the mind becomes absolutely solid, not moving at all, like a rock, like a diamond, not even trembling. When that happens, then you do have the real perspective to understand what thinking is all about. As in any quality of the world, when you are immersed in it, when it's always around you, you can't have a full understanding of what it is. When you leave that completely, when there's no thinking, there's no movement of the mind, and you get into, say, a second jhana, from there you will have the perspective of what thinking is all about, what movement of mind is all about, and what makes the world of thought which most people live in. Now, the thinking I like, I don't like, the thinking that this is good, this is bad, now, all the thinking of, you know, what you think Buddhism is, what you think Dharma is, and arguing with your friends, now, thinking that I'm, you know, unhappy, I'm happy, that I'm anxious, thinking about the past and valuing it, all that starts to unravel with a full understanding of vitakka, the thinking of the mind. And also that one of the aspects of vitakka, of thinking, is will, which I keep on mentioning, that, you know, as one wills, that is, as it were, a movement of the mind. Subverbal, but very often comes with the thoughts of what you intend. I want this. And if you actually start to slow the thoughts down, to calm them down until all the thoughts disappear, then the will disappears with thought. When there's no thought, there's no will left. There's no choosing. When that happens, and you've calmed down thinking so much, there's not even any will left there, and that becomes a wonderful experience. Because this will which you think is you, you're free of will. And when we talk about free will, that's the best free will, the free of will, the freedom from will. So the jitta is there, not being pushed and pulled, not being forced to go here and to come here and to go there because of chaitanya. Chaitanya is like a slave master, always telling you what to do. And you think it's you doing this, but it's just a master, a mistress, and very demanding and never letting up. Even when you go to sleep, sometimes the will keeps on moving the mind in dreams, moving the body in your bed, telling you what to do, where to go, what to think about, all coming from will. Imagine when you're free from that, you're free from this tyrant inside of you. Imagine what that's like. That's called the bliss of samadhi, of second jhana, and above. So you understand that even will is dukkha. Fascinating insight that, again, not through thinking, but through experience, that, you know, that something which you thought so fundamental to yourself is anicca, because it was there before, now it's disappeared. It's suffering, because when will is not there, it's so much more fun. And also, because it's gone, it can't be you, it can't be an essential part of the self. All these coming from the experience of these deep states of meditation. So you can see, you can't think your way to these places. All thinking just misses the point. But where do we actually let go of thinking, and imagine, and allow the thinking to subside, we get into these beautiful states, then we can actually see what this thinking was all about, and what ending of thinking is all about, what will is and the end of will is. You get heaps and heaps of insights through this. And it's insights which aren't just useful for the coffee table, for arguments, or writing books or becoming a famous monk. These are insights which actually will stop you thinking outside of your meditation, which make you more peaceful in your mind, more still in what you do, so you're not so worried about the world. Because how much suffering comes from thoughts in your life so far? Whenever you've got really anxious, upset, angry, are you quiet inside, or are you thinking more than usual? You'll find that just nearly all suffering is associated with an increase in thinking. So as we calm thoughts down more and more, you can expect more and more happiness, more and more freedom, coming closer and closer to the truth. Which is why that this practice, of meditation, this practice of Dharma, the Eightfold Path, can be described as, you know, the cessation of thinking. When we talk about the second of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samasankappa, which is sometimes even called right intention or right thought. The first one of the right intentions, Nekamma Sankappa, thoughts of renunciation. What you're renouncing is thought of itself. Renouncing thought. Not thought of renunciation, but renunciation of thought. And if one can do that, it's just another possible meaning of the compound. And as one renounces thought, renounces that movement of the mind, renounces that discontent which causes that movement, one comes closer and closer to the stillness of the mind where you actually see the Dhamma, not think about it. So the talk which I've given today is starting off just with ordinary practice of not thinking too much, you know, in your daily life, not thinking at the beginning of the meditation, and the skillful means to stop that. Remember, substitution, but only substitute something which is more beautiful than all the thoughts which you've had so far. The present moment is more beautiful. The breath in the present moment is more beautiful. Loving kindness, reflection on the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha is more beautiful. Doing walking meditation, just feeling the feet go up and down, is more beautiful. Develop that perception of the beauty in the silence. You'll find you'll incline more and more to silence. You incline more and more to the contentment in that silence. Incline more and more to the cessation of all thinking and control. Incline more and more to the first jhana. Incline to the second jhana. And incline to the ending of all thought and all will. And incline to the realization that the thoughts are suffering. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. All sankharas, and this is one of the sankharas, thinking is suffering. And tezang vupassamo sukho. Just the calming of those is happiness. And so you don't need to think your way to happiness. You stop thinking and happiness is there. You stop searching through thought. You let go. And you have all the joy and bliss you could ever want. So this is leading to the realization of powerful truths, which you can parlay into the realization of enlightenment itself. So during this retreat period, I look upon thought as a big enemy. Look upon it as like a dead dog, like a carcass which you pull around this beautiful mind, this beautiful opportunity for peace, for bliss, for liberation. Don't entertain it. Entertain silence instead. And by developing the mind in these ways with these perceptions, I can guarantee that silence will grow and all the thoughts will gradually just be discarded from you. And you find freedom. Freedom from fear, freedom from worry, from anxiety, freedom from guilt about the past, free from all thoughts and judgments, and free from control, and free from worry, and free from the world, free into bliss. So tezang vupassamo sukho, the calming of those thoughts is bliss. So may you all calm your thoughts down during this retreat. May you have lots and lots of happiness, free from the past and the future, free from all the thinking and naming, free into the bliss states of jhanas, having a wonderful time in this retreat. Thank you. Are there any questions on this evening's talk? Yes? Okay, I was in my talk, I suggested to avoid pain. Some teachers say that you should look for pain in order to cultivate one-pointedness, and can I comment on that? The best comment I can make upon that is the Buddha's teaching of the middle way, and the story of the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, before he was enlightened for 6 years, he sought out pain and endured enormous amounts of pain and had a great deal of willpower to endure such pain. But from that experience, not having gained enlightenment or even close to enlightenment, that he made a powerful statement just after the enlightenment, that such is called Atigalamatana Yoga. It's dukkha, it's suffering, analaya. It's anarya. It's not of the noble ones. It is anatta sanyata. It is not connected with the goal. And that's a powerful statement which the Buddha made. And he's basically said that don't follow that. That the way to develop the jhanas is not through pain, it's through comfort, through contentment. Going through pain can be helpful from time to time, but as a path into the jhanas, it's not really recommended. Sometimes you can be very, very strong and sit through pain until basically the mind just gives up and goes into a bliss state. But it's not a recommended way to get into the bliss states. There's much easier ways, and the other ways would be more full of insights and wisdoms on the path. So I've seen too many people having problems because they try and push through pain. Only one or two actually manage to do that, and usually they've got tremendous samadhi to begin with. I see many, many people try that practice and they just get more and more frustrated, even injure their bodies. And of course, the example of the Buddha, Atigalamatana Yoga, one of the extremes which the Buddha said one should not practice. So it's not being cruel to the body, it's not looking for pain. Sometimes pain comes and you've got no choice in the matter. That's a different matter. You're not looking for pain. You know, sometimes you're sick or you're ill, and then you can actually deal with the pain because you're content with the pain. But you don't go looking for it. Which is why that this monastery runs this particular way. You know, we have very nice food here, so it's not painful to eat in the morning and at lunchtime. You've got lovely huts and rooms, they're not painful. You've even got heaters in some of those rooms, and you've got hot showers. But even if you want to test me out on that, then just for the next week, just have a cold shower. Instead of sleeping in your room, sleep outside and see what pain does to you. And see if you can get concentrated. And I think that you'll probably get sick before you get concentrated. So I wouldn't recommend sort of pushing through pain. I'd rather push through thoughts. You know, push through the discontent. Push through those things rather than pushing through pain. And that would be much more conducive to the deep states of meditation, to insights and to enlightenment. It's happened also that sometimes in meditation retreats, when people are starting to try and push through pain, they get all frustrated, they come and see me and want to leave. And the usual advice I give to people, you've heard me say this before, I say, you're trying too hard. I tell them, it's the afternoon now, I order them to go back to their room and take a nap. After the nap, have a shower. After the shower, have a cup of tea or coffee, and then go and sit meditation. And consistently, people have come afterwards and said, thank you very much, that was the best meditation of the whole retreat. And it's because that they've gone back to the middle way, rather than gone back to asceticism. Be careful. I've got good meditation. I suppose I'm a bit austere, but I'm not really ascetic. So look at the other monks who've got good meditation, see what they do. So remember the Eightfold, remember the Middle Way. Okay, I think one question is enough. Thank you.
Aham Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavatam Abhivadin Suvakato Bhagavata Namo Dhammanamassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvakāto.